From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. Well, like all great ideas, what Wax Poetics magazine did when it started 10 years ago was fill in a gap. No magazine had ever treated hip-hop and the forms that led to hip-hop, from funk to R&B to jazz to salsa, thoughtfully. Its creator and editor-in-chief, Andre Torres, was among the first to do that with his magazine, celebrating 10 years. I'm thrilled to have him here sitting across from me. Andre, thanks so much for being here.
Elvis, thank you for having me. I'm honored.
One of the things that the magazine really does is treat hip-hop culture thoughtfully, because there tend to be two kinds of magazines that went to extremes, either the rough and ready stuff like The Source in the early days or Double XL, or people that were treated so much so scholarly that it seemed almost condescending. And what you really do with the magazine is get into the roots and the guts of it and all these influences from people like Al Cooper to Oliver Sane. I mean, it's a wide expanse of people who fed into what hip-hop culture is.
Yeah. You know, when we started, I definitely saw a void. You know, I grew up listening to hip-hop, and, you know, I was one of the first of that generation who really saw it as our music. And when I looked at the magazines, I didn't see it. It almost appeared as if hip-hop occurred in a vacuum. There was no cultural connection to anything else that had happened previously. And it was sort of, you know, flavor of the month, you know, one thing on to the next one. So I saw the opportunity, you know, once I became very obsessive and sort of grew beyond just wanting to read about, you know, this new record that X artist had out. It was really about obsessively looking through liner notes and understanding how these albums were being put together. And, you know, I would recognize something in a sample and not quite know, and trying to figure out exactly what it was, and then trying to sort of track those records down to understand how they were piecing this music together. Because, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I went to art school, and so I was very much trained in, you know, cubism and modern art and understanding the ideas of collage and postmodernism. So I always saw hip hop as this very sort of postmodern approach to music, sort of deconstructing this stuff from the past and just piecing it back together in a way that made sense to us.
And also the way that you grew up in studying, it was always commenting on itself.
Yes, yes, exactly. I mean, you know, it was self-referential. So I thought, you know, there was really no one looking at this music in an intelligent way that talked about that history and sort of this very artistic approach that these guys were taking. And I needed to see and show people, especially younger kids, African-American kids, how this all came to be, that it wasn't just something that came out of nowhere and people just started rhyming all of a sudden and spinning on their backs. There was precedent for this. And I think most of these magazines then and still now are missing that point. And so I thought that was really where we would come in.
Well, the interesting thing, too, we were saying before we got started, I was saying that all those magazines, if we think of those 80s, 90s hip-hop magazines, really rap magazines, treat everything as if it were a turf war, and they were fighting for – they were basically acting as if they were MCs themselves and want to be crowned kings by the people they were writing about.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and that's a very strange thing because, you know, in journalism – you know, that's not normal. You don't see that occurring with Time and Newsweek battling it out like that. But, yeah, somehow this was hip-hop. You know, these journalists became part of the game of hip-hop. And, you know, there was really no one sort of taking a step back and looking at this as music and talking about the music and the process and how this was all made. And so, you know, I saw they were all sort of missing the boat. You know, they were kind of touching on it. They may have one article with a producer talking about samples, but it wasn't something that, you know, they were all kind of compacted in one place. So that's what I really did. I laid them all out. What's going on right now in rap journalism 10 years ago? And I pulled individual pages out of magazines and said, this is the magazine I want. You know, it's one place that I can find all of this stuff. that they're not doing really in full. And so we just dove right in. I had really no experience in journalism or running a magazine. And it was kind of a, you know, blind faith, I think, and naivete that really kind of propelled this whole thing. And it seems to have worked out.
Worked out very well. It's the treatment.
Thank you,
sir. At KCRW.com. My guest is the founder and editor-in-chief of Wax Poetics Magazine, Andre Torres. And I think I heard something really interesting, that you were working as a guard at the World Trade Center and were fired in August of 2001.
Actually, yeah, I was a guard. That was a previous life, working at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Oh, my God. So you got that close to art.
Yeah. So because I thought I wanted to be an artist full time in New York, and that's what most artists do when they come to New York. And, you know, standing there all day surrounded by some of the world's greatest art was great. But then when all day you're sort of, you know, it's a barrage of tourists asking you where the bathroom is, it kind of cuts into that moment of bliss. So, you know, I cut my dreads off and went into the corporate world. I actually was a recruiter and business development executive at the World Trade Center. I worked on the 78th floor of Tower 1. And, yeah, I got fired August 4th, a month before the towers went down, because at the time I had started the magazine about a year prior to that. And I really was losing focus. I was miserable working in that world. I knew I needed to do something creative, but I had now had a touch and a taste of this corporate world. I knew what I could do and what I didn't want to do. And so I found a sort of perfect balance between art and commerce with publishing and magazine. I thought initially the idea came to me as maybe a documentary, even though I had no previous experience in film either. I just saw this subculture of beat digging as this, you know, sort of fifth element of hip hop. There was this talk of, you know, DJing and graffiti writing and rhyming. And I thought, you know, there's this subculture of people who are obsessively digging for these breakbeats that were kind of the foundation of hip hop. They started sort of just playing doubles of these records, the old DJs back in the Bronx. That evolved into some of these same beats being sampled in hip-hop tracks. And, you know, even that was late 80s, some of these same tracks, break beats, are still being used in not only hip-hop, but electronic music, pop music.
It and one of the early issues of the magazine, Roy Ayers talks about how the most sampled artist, just because of that very phenomenon you're talking about. That he used were being used by everybody.
And I just didn't think that anybody had sort of pulled the sort of veil back from this world and sort of looked at the science of how this was all put together, really. So the idea was, oh, let's do a documentary on this group of beat diggers. And then, you know, I went to do research and went to bookstores and libraries trying to find things on these artists, books, documents, newspaper clippings, anything. And, you know, there was, you know, you go to the music section in Barnes & Noble or even the Strand, and it's filled with, you know, biographies on Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and, you know, and no, I love those guys are great, but, you know, that wasn't all there was, but that seems to be the only thing that people wanted to write about. And I thought, well, where's my James Brown biography? Where's my Sly Stone biography? You know, since we've started, those books have come, but at the time, they didn't exist. And I thought, well, these are like the major artists. What about David Axelrod and the Oliver Sanes and all the guys who, Eddie Bowe, who have kind of slipped through the cracks that most people will never do a biography on? Who's going to tell their story? So I thought, well, if I can't find any real research materials to put a documentary together on this, then someone needs to put something together so that if 5 years from now somebody does want to do a documentary on this, there's actually something he can go and refer to.
It's the treatment. The very passionate man I'm talking to is Andre Torres, the founder and editor-in-chief of Wax Poetics Magazine, one of the best magazines on the stands today. You can hear the show at KCRW.com. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is that it's, in addition to everything else, it's a physically beautiful magazine.
I mean,
in the early issues of the magazine, though, you use art on the cover and you transition into photographs on both sides. And I wonder what precipitated that move, because it was very much Touch magazine, where you were saying you're using art as a way to sort of use that art the way the artists use them on the covers and those right. pieces to comment on what the magazine was. And going from that kind of more kind of epistemological approach to mm-hmm. a more direct pictorial approach is a really interesting thing to have done.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was, like I said, very naive to the business of publishing. And, you know, I just wanted to create a beautiful magazine. I had my degree in painting and knew artists and illustrators and older graffiti artists that I respected that we were coming into contact with. And then I thought, you know, I would love for you to do artwork for the cover. And then I would get calls from my distributor, and he'd be like, you've got an article on the Funk Brothers inside, but I don't, no one knows. You can't see it. There's no taglines. There's no nothing. So, you know, you're killing yourself. You're shooting yourself in the foot here. And, you know, I thought, get out of here. You know, what do you want from me? We're just trying to make a cool magazine here. And, you know, as the years went by and it sort of, you know, got wiser to the game. And, you know, I think Anna Wintour, if there's anyone to blame, she's probably the one, because she really kind of started this sort of celebrity-driven newsstand that is, you know, everyone's sort of
well, it really goes back to Tina Brown and the old Vanity Fair.
Ah, yes. Yes. Yes, definitely. I forget. That's a huge part of it as well. So, you know, I don't think there's a way to kind of escape that anymore. I thought, you know, we would try to find some sort of balance to that. I mean, I wasn't going to put Brad Pitt on the cover, but,
you
know, yes, of course. You're welcome. But, you know, there were obviously idols in our world, people that were cover worthy that I thought, you know, it kind of came to sort of a crossroads when, you know, we had kind of done this insanely beautiful cover by the graffiti artist, one of the legendary pioneers, Phase Two. And the next issue we had the Meters in it, and it was like the best article I had ever read, and thought, you know, maybe this is the time, maybe this is that moment where let's just try this. And I don't think we really set out to make it that way, because we've done a couple of smaller illustration covers since then.
But we say you also have two covers on each issue of the magazine.
Yes,
a front
yes.
and a back cover.
We started doing back cover as well to sort of give us some more options. And then also, you know, like I said, we really wanted to connect the dots between this past and what was going on in the present. So it was important that we could kind of bridge that gap, and, you know, where I could put Al Green on the front and Q-Tip on the back and really show both sides of this world and the two audiences that we were really trying to communicate with. Because, you know, this isn't my father's funk magazine. You know, though there are guys in their 50s and 60s who read this, you know, this is for us, you know. And I mean, I'm getting old now, but, you know, this is like the 20 and 30 something guy magazine. It's for the guy who grew up in hip hop. When we talk about Miles Davis, let's say, we're not going back to his cool period and discussing this sort of evolution and modal jazz. We go right into his electric period, and we want to hear about how Miles was struggling to get young black kids to listen to jazz, and how, you know, he was getting funky, you know, because I think that's really at the core of all of this and really modern music.
Founder and editor-in-chief of Waxwork Magazine, Andre Torres. It's a treatment. We'll take a break. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm still bathing in the energy of my guest, founder and editor-in-chief of Wax Poetics Magazine, Andre Torres. It's the 10th anniversary of Wax Poetics Magazine. And one of the things, before we talk in the break, in almost every piece, there's one point when the artist either says, or in the analysis of the artist's career, that moment of coalescence, you know, that crystallization mm-hmm. moment where they talk about the audience has got what we were doing. And that's the thing that I find to be missing from so many other things, because the magazine's bent is to sort of get to that moment where they realize what they have become and also when audiences are responding. Is that something that happened by accident, or is that something you want to do from the outset?
Well, I think it was kind of a combination of both. I didn't know how it would occur, but I mean, we knew there were these guys out there who were kind of unsung heroes, and I don't think they even quite maybe were aware how important they were to this audience. You know, maybe they never had this sort of pop smash hit career, but guys that, you know, were, you know, even like the Meters, you know, who hold a very special place in the hearts of hip-hop heads and funk lovers all over. And I think...
And rock and R&B.
And I mean, rock and R&B,
they are
yeah.
probably at the center of it more than any other group you can name.
Definitely. That New Orleans sound, I think, is a sort of integral part of modern music, you know, and that syncopated drum beat that Zigaboo was laying down is at the foundation of all of this. So, you know, I think we were really trying to make sure that we kind of at least push these guys with questions that frame this so that it would come out naturally.
You say Zigaboo, Ziggy the drummer, Ziggy Marley. That's so interesting. I'm even thinking back to one of the early issues where Deodato talks about basically improvising,
right.
Also Sprock Zarathustra. But right. that moment, it happens in so many of those pieces. And in rereading all the issues to get ready for this, and it's been the most fun preparation I've ever had to do an interview.
Thank you.
I just found myself fascinated by that almost every one of those people has that kind of, you know, tap on the side of the beaker moment. And that's something that's missing from pop culture commentary, that sort of realization that they have something different to offer
right.
at that moment where the audience has come to it.
Yes.
And in a way, it's almost a metaphor of what the magazine is doing.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great way of looking at it. Thank you. I mean, you know, I felt that we needed to be the ones to frame this for people, because there was really no one else out there bringing this to light. And some of these guys are just genius in the way that they were able to take disparate parts of jazz and roll it together with Latin music. You know, Deodato is a perfect example, and add those funk elements and, you know, really just kind of take it somewhere else. And while there were critics who were, you know, at the time, a lot of these guys were getting it from critics. You know, they were not...
Oh, they call it bubblegum music or look
yeah,
down on all of them
yeah.
because the idea of having a backbeat in jazz...
Exactly.
They excused Miles for doing it, but anybody else was basically...
They were coming down on him, too, at one point.
Well, after the big fun, they kind of went, well, okay, we
right,
get it now.
Right. You know, and I said that in our last jazz issue. We had George Benson and some of the Jamaica funk cats and...
The whole piece in that world of Jamaica, New York, we should say that
yeah.
very specifically.
Yes.
It regards like Marcus Miller and Tom Brown, who
totally.
Basically...
Weldon Irvine.
Yes, all yeah. these guys who grew up in middle-class, educated households listening to jazz who became jazz funk players.
Yeah, because, you know, I think I understand if you grew up listening to Miles Davis early stuff or Charlie Parker, you know, there's that, you want to hold on to that, to the purity of that art. But you can't expect that 20, 30 years later, young kids are going to want to hear this. And so, you know, I think these guys were really kind of trying to push this music to keep jazz relevant. It was our great music. And I mean, no disrespect to anyone doing jazz now, but it certainly lost touch with the youth and with the general public. I mean, most people find it difficult to listen to I hear my father tell me about when he was in high school, that's what they would go to the party with. They had their jazz records underneath their arm and like walked in ready to get down, and everybody was trading records and playing them, and it was jazz music they were getting down to. And you know, I hear it was, I think, Phil Corin who mentioned in that jazz issue that moment where the guys like Bird and Dizzy, and suddenly no one wanted to dance. They wanted to walk up, stand in front of the stage, and stare. And, you know, these guys could solo for 20 minutes. I mean, these guys were geniuses, but that's not something that you can keep going. Those geniuses don't come like that every year. And so I think we've created a situation where we're trying to recreate that world over and over and over again. But that moment is past. It's let these younger cats bring that groove back into it. If that's what it's going to take to get younger kids listening to jazz, so be it. You know, I think it only makes sense. And so, you know, thank God there's still elements of that. But I listen to jazz radio, and it's so painful because they completely ignore some of the best jazz that's been made only because it has a backbeat and a funky bass line. And to me, that's just silly.
By the way, that's not me dissing jazz radio. That's my guest founder and editor-in-chief of Wax Poetics magazine, Andre Torres. It's the treatment. Send those complaints to KCRW.com. You can also hear the show. One of the things, though, that's so much fun about the magazine, and you mentioned David Axelrod, and to date, he's the only person you ever had a two-part piece on him, am I right?
I believe so, yeah.
And one of the things that when you move to photographs, you have an eye for drama. I mean, the photographs used on the cover are incredibly dramatic.
Thank you.
But they're also pictures that aren't that well known.
Right.
And I just wonder, in choosing those pictures, I mean, it's like you're trying to create a sense of theater to lend to the storytelling, because there is a narrative arc to each of these musics that's in each of the pieces.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I went to art school. So, you know, I wanted this magazine to be our visual document of this, because we're talking about this kind of specific moment in time. Though we sort of range from, you know, early 60s jazz, samba, whatever, into, you know, up until the most current music being made. When we do an article on some guy from the 70s, or David Axelrod, let's say.
Or the Mizell brothers.
Or the Mizell brothers.
Yeah.
We became very close with the Mizells. We reissued one of their early 45s that they did. So.
And we should say now, you're now in the business. I mean, because I always wonder too, again, is it a gap you happen to fill? These records had to disappear, because so many pieces in the magazine where you get somebody to talk about their favorite 45s or albums, mm-hmm. these things cannot be found,
right.
Or there are only ever 500 copies, and you can see the glee in a copy. I have one to copy of this, good luck finding it kinds of pieces.
Exactly.
So you stepped in to fill that void as well.
Yeah, we kind of were brought the first project, which was an old release from the Army. It was East Underground, a sort of battle of the bands that the Army did, and this band kind of came in second place to this sort of folky psych rock band, but collectors, you know, there were only a couple of hundred copies made, and this thing goes for like a couple thousand dollars. Collectors are clamoring to get this copy. They kind of disregard the folk record because it's a double record set, but it's all about this sort of funk soul group, East of Underground, that was just a collection of soldiers. And it was kind of brought to us by one of our writers who had done the research, gone to the Army, got them to pull the only copy that they had in their vaults, which were still in Germany because it was recorded in Germany, and he got the rights. It really is kind of public domain stuff because it was put out by the Army. Yeah, so they were like, yeah, sure. And I mean, in the middle of a war, I thought, really? They're really going to let us put one of their records out? They took the time and actually made it happen. So, yeah, we kind of have evolved from just doing reissues into now we have a series of new acts that we've signed. And we've done some soundtracks. We did the soundtrack to the movie Black Dynamite two years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're looking forward. We've got the follow-up record coming out from that artist, Adrian Young, later this year.
By the way, it's the treatment. I'm talking to a renegade of funk, founder and editor-in-chief of Wax Poetics magazine, Andre Torres. You can also see the show at KCRW.com.
I just wanted to mention how, you know, we're very specific in trying to provide this pictorial moment. We kind of have gone to great lengths to find these photos that most people have never seen before from this very specific period. I mean, the Mizells are a perfect example in that they sent me Polaroids. You know, most of the stuff that we used in that article were things out of their own personal collection. Same with the meters. These were things that they had to go into their attics. And it's a struggle sometimes to get these artists to sort of, because they've never been asked hey, can I have some of your personal photos? Because there aren't press shots of these guys. You know, there's very small houses around that deal in archival photography that do have some of this stuff for some of the bigger artists, but a lot of them, they just don't exist. And so, you know, like I said, this isn't your dad's funk magazine. I don't necessarily want to see some of these guys at the age of 70 bald and fat. We're creating this moment that we're dealing with from the 60s and 70s that's very specific time moment, and we want to make sure that the photos are a reflection of that. So we go to great lengths to make sure that when we put this together, it's almost like a time capsule. We're really kind of taking you back 100%, you know, with the content, photos, everything, to make sure that you're really kind of going back to that place. And that's one of the things I think I'm most proud of, is the way that we've been able to sort of assemble these very visually stunning issues.
Because also these people kind of at their peaks, they're kind of sort of photographic peaks. I mean, they look like young lions, all these pictures.
Exactly.
I mean, there's so many intense looks in recording studios. And it's fascinating, too, because it's also about a period where the producers weren't getting their due, unless were somebody like Bob Clearmountain or Bill Simzik, one of these guys producing for a white pop act. Nobody paid any attention to you.
So true.
And now these people are all getting kind of, you know, there's just a piece recently on Nightline about Lady Gaga's producer. So nowadays, I mean, if these people are around now, they would be getting their due. But one of the things the magazine does is really understand how integral the producer is. And the producers were as much artists as the people they're working with, is one of the things that I think is really the raison d'etre of the magazine.
Especially back then, I think, you know, you had so many artists that were, you know, really not writing their own music. They weren't even writing their own lyrics a lot of times. You know, there were teams of people. I mean, you look at Motown, we just did Holland and Dozier.
Yeah, big Dozier
Lamont
piece.
Dozier. And, you know, you look at these old photos of he and the two Holland brothers sitting at the piano with, like, the Supremes sitting all together, you know, as they're trying to bang out these chords on the piano and scribbling down lyrics and trying to get them to understand the proper phrasing and how to get that right, because it took that team of people to really, you know, churn those hits out. And I think it was important for us to make sure that you understood that, you know, these guys were the backbone of this. I mean, a lot of times, you know, it was these drummers that were coming up with these great riffs. It was the guys that were kind of, you know, that you didn't see, the Clyde Stubblefields and Bernard Purdy's, guys that, you know, most people don't know.
My guest is the founder and editor-in-chief of Waxworks Magazine, Andre Torres. Please go out and get the new issues. Find them wherever you can. They're so worth collecting. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruess. This show was edited and mixed by J.C. Swadek. I don't live in Brooklyn, baby. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
I love it.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.